Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The Joint Finance Committee begins taking votes on state agencies, while GOP leaders and Governor Evers continue to hammer out a deal on tax cuts. Plus, Senator Ron Johnson says he won't back down from his demands to make changes to President Donald Trump's budget bill. And the Department of Public Instruction launches an effort to revamp student report cards. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for May 30th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We begin with the Joint Finance Committee slowly getting underway at the Capitol. They did meet on Thursday. Now, they didn't take up any major big-ticket items like education, tax cuts, transportation, but some lower-tier state agencies like the Department of Safety and Professional Services. So what they did is that they extended another 3 years of five project positions at DSPS, its call center operation. And the committee also granted a funding request to monitorize the Department of Employee Trust Fund's pension system to allow participants and employees to access the information online. Great. So yes, they're meeting. That's always a good sign. But we really didn't see anything for about 2-3 weeks after they took the big significant step of removing over 600 policy items from Governor Tony Evers. So the big question is, what are they going to take up next? When are they going to meet next? Because we know there's a lot going on with tax cuts as well.
Well, we got a list of like a dozen, 18 things that they could take up next. This is what's unusual. So Finance Committee typically will notice a hearing. Let's say they're coming out on a Tuesday. You will get the budget papers, which are each agency and like the background on what they're going to do. They'll tell you on May whatever, here are your agencies we're going to take up. All we got was a list of agencies and no dates. So that's unusual. But what's happening in the Capitol is unusual in general. So yes, Tony Evers and his staff are talking to Robin Voss and Devin Lemieux. That is unusual. It's also unusual, though, that we're picking up from Republican lawmakers, a rank and file, they're not being told by leadership what is going on, what they're negotiating about, what's in this deal. Now, they know generally the big things are tax cut, education, University of Wisconsin system, and child care. The last thing is what Evers wants, right? Tax cut, what Republicans want. They know the parameters. They know what's going into this thing. And why that's kind of tricky is you need buy-in from your caucus to vote for something. So if they just put a budget in front of them and say, here, this is what we got from Evers, vote for it, there'll be a revolt by members. So my question is, when do they start wooing their own members to buy into what they're doing with Evers? Now, part of what they're not doing, telling stuff, is they don't want people like you and I getting wind of what they're talking about and reporting. They're negotiating X, Y, and Z. I get that. But again, you're making your life more difficult to get buy-in in the end of this process. But we're doing right now.
Right. We're doing our jobs asking the co-chairs of Joint Finance, what's going on? Do you have any details on the tax plan? Everyone is so tight-lipped. We're not going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about what's going on behind closed doors. But I think there is a big question. Well, are you being informed on what's going on behind closed doors? Now, moving on to those meetings that are happening, we know Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Senate Majority Leader, and the governor are trying to still schedule their third meeting after initially meeting back on March 26th, like I said, to discuss tax cuts and other priorities in the state budget. March 26th, that has now almost been 2 months since they originally met. We don't know if they're making progress. It's always a promising sign to get these three individuals in a room together, no doubt. That is newsworthy. But when are we going to find out what it is? We don't know.
So there were talks last week involving the governor, Voss, and Lemieux. Voss went to his caucus and said, actually, they met twice in one day, morning and afternoon. Okay, we know that. They're working on more meetings scheduled. Talk continued this week. We still don't have details of those or a deal. And why it's important is June 30th is the end of the fiscal year. In Wisconsin, there's nothing like the federal government where there's no budget, it shuts down. However, there's a symbolism there of getting the budget done on time. Give you some perspective, the Finance Committee has met twice, or will meet twice for the end of May. I went back to the last four budgets. The closest one was four times at the end of May, and they'd done K-12 education. They'd done University of Wisconsin. They'd done some big things. No offense to the Safety and Professional Services, that's not a big agency. So we are behind schedule in meeting, also behind schedule in the heavy lifts. Corrections, UW, Medicaid, taxes. Those are the big things that drive corrections. They drive budget spending. When they do those things, those kind of shape everything else.
Right. And like you said, once the end of June happens, once July reaches, there's no catastrophic event mm-hmm. that happens like the federal government. There's no government shutdown. But if we start inching towards October, that's this time for local governments, schools especially, to start panicking. Now, I'm not saying that's where we're going to get at. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of time to find compromise between GOP leaders and the governor. But that is really the pressure point date that I'm watching for to see if we eventually get there, because that's when local governments need to know how much to budget for, especially schools as well.
Well, schools, they kind of have some certainty because of the 400-year veto the governor issued. They know like how much they can spend. They know how much they're going to get from state aid versus property taxes, right? So there's some idea there. Republicans, though, don't want certainty for four centuries is going on. And there's a shared revenue deal from a couple of years ago that they're tied now to sales tax collection. So there's something there. But still, you don't want to go into October. I saw that in 2007.
I was just going to bring that up. I looked that up as well.
There was Democratic-controlled state Senate, Democratic Governor Jim Doyle, Republican Assembly. They couldn't get something out of it. They got a deadlocked vote in the Finance Committee. It went to both houses. They passed different budgets. Started meeting in private end of September. Got something out that was rejected.
October 23rd is when they finally got it done.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, can you see that scenario? Sure. But I don't know if we don't panic about that just yet.
Right. And that's also another unique circumstance because it's a divided legislature. We still have divided government. Just a little different scenario there. All right, let's talk about Senator Ron Johnson, because he headlined a newsmaker event also co-hosted by Wiz Politics. I was on the panel reporter. I covered a lot of topics that we're going to dive into, as you can see on your slide. A lot of highlights. Let's just first start with the budget bill backlash, because Senator Ron Johnson is making national news for his staunch opposition to President Donald Trump's budget bill, which includes a lot of his priorities, border security measures, tax cuts, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the biggest holdup is that Ron Johnson says, I'm not going to succumb to any pressure, even if it's from the president, GOP leadership, and I am not going to back down from my demands to cut spending. I want this to cut even more in this bill. Let's first just take a listen to what he has to say, and then we'll dive into the other topics that he discussed.
There's no amount of pressure that President Trump can apply to me that exceeds the pressure I feel, the promises I made to stop mortgaging our kids' future. Rather than try and twist my arm to pass a one big beautiful bill that doesn't meet the moment, he ought to be twisting members of the House and the Senate that aren't willing to cut the waste, fraud, and abuse.
So everyone kind of wants to know, well, what will it take for you to get that vote, right? He keeps saying he wants to go back to pre-pandemic spending levels. But what else? There's so much in this bill, and he's not really being too specific. But you can't always get what you want sometimes.
Yeah. Look, it might be illustrative to go back to 2017. He initially had problems with the first Trump tax cut package. He wanted more generous treatment of smaller companies, pass-throughs is what they call them. He held up that bill until he got a little bit of what he wanted. So the bill proposed a tax cut of this much or a tax rate this much for pass-throughs. He wanted this much. He got something kind of in the middle. So the question I'm hearing from people is, okay, he wants pre-pandemic spending. That's never going to happen. You can't pass that bill with the moderates in his caucus in the House who won't go for it. So where is that sweet spot between pre-pandemic spending, where we're at right now? He goes, okay, this is good enough for me that I could be on board. He says no amount of pressure could make him break, but what could they give him to get him like on board for final passage?
All right. And moving on to another topic that was discussed at this panel was President Joe Biden, former President Biden's health investigation that Ron Johnson is leading. He shared just a little bit of tidbits about that, saying that he is prepared to subpoena former Biden officials if they do not voluntarily come and testify in front of his committee to talk about accusations that are going on right now that the White House kept secret Biden's declining health.
Well, this is why Johnson is happy as you can be with the subcommittee on investigations. He gets to look into stuff. He can do hearings on COVID and COVID injuries, he calls them. He can do hearings in the Biden administration, try and call these guys in. This is what Ron Johnson kind of lives for, the spotlight of saying, I demand this on the budget. and a reconciliation and the opportunity to have these investigations going on all the time.
All right. And another topic I want to talk about is the measles vaccine. I asked him about the recent COVID news of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. really scaling back recommendations for children and pregnant women. And then he kind of talked about the measles vaccine and raised falsehoods that it could be connected to a rise in autism rates. Now, we know that there's been numerous studies by the CDC and others that have said that is not true, but this is kind of another area where sometimes Ron Johnson just says things, they stick, they're in the news cycle for a while, but it doesn't really impact him politically.
No, he's a contrarian to the medical community, essentially. I mean, COVID has really shaped his view about science and the medical community in general.
All right, moving on, just the last topic that we want to talk about is Milwaukee's lead crisis. Of course, this is a lot of dangerous levels of lead that have led to a series of school closures at Milwaukee Public Schools. There's been this big argument from city and state officials saying, hey, feds, we need your help. We need money to get this accomplished, to remove lead. Ron Johnson says, well, no, it's your responsibility. Milwaukee has known about this for years. When I talk to Republicans about this issue, they also would agree, right? You can't just throw money at a problem. If you've known about this for so many years, that's what they say. You should just tackle it, deal with it. This has been an ongoing debate in the Milwaukee area for a long time now. Where it goes, we don't know, but this is also an issue because RFK Jr., I believe it was last week, told a panel of lawmakers that, yes, there are federal officials on the grounds in Milwaukee. Well, the Milwaukee Health Department disputed that. So it's just this ongoing tussle that's going on with this issue. Where it would ultimately end, we'll just be keeping tabs on it. Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to our committee wrap this week. Some newer bills that we want to talk about. Let's start with SB 280. This would require the Evers at Edmond to allocate $172 million in interest generated from federal pandemic aid to the state's general fund. SB 154 prohibit food share recipients from using their benefits to purchase candy and soda. And then AB 269 would grant benefits to delivery and rideshare drivers. Those are individuals that work for Uber, DoorDash, Lyft, etc. SB 280 is pretty interesting, too, because this is something that we haven't really seen before dealing with pandemic aid, Jared.
Well, it's a question of when is federal money? So what happened was the state received all this federal money from COVID-19 packages. They put it into an account. It draws interest. Typically, the federal government requires you to return the interest on money they give you for stuff like that. Okay, typically. The feds waive that requirement. So did they give us that money or not? That is the question. So typically under state law, anything like that must be deposited in a general fund. Federal funds, however, the governor has sole authority over. Remember that constitutional amendment last year that was shot down, try to give lawmakers a say? Okay, for the most part, federal money, governor has to do with it. His administration argues that by waiving the requirement to return the interest, the federal government gave us that interest. In turn, it became federal money. Eric Wimberger, a Republican from the Green Bay Area, says that's ludicrous. That is not federal money. They never had their hands on it. That are state funds that should be deposited in a state account. Now, he said during the hearing that they're trying to work out a deal with the governor, kind of get him on board to see what state law says. During the hearing, lawmaker from Beloit, Mark Spreitzer, said, well, look, you guys sue over everything. Why not sue over this? Wimberger said, well, we're kind of trying to have to go there. Also, it's a misdemeanor if you don't correctly appropriate funds. We don't want to talk about impeachment. And he cautioned, that is not what we're talking about. We're just saying those are escalations we don't want to do. We want to try to reach an agreement first. But it'd be an interesting case because legislative council, which is the nonpartisan legal arm of legislature, basically it's an open question about who should have control of this money. You probably need a court to say who for sure means lawsuit, means more legal fees for taxpayers to cover that, but we'll see that ends up there.
And Republicans for years has been targeting these COVID funds, right? Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, there was that constitutional amendment and other efforts of bills that the governor's vetoed that would try and give the legislature the authority and how to spend federal funding because they thought it was wasteful of how Evers did throughout the pandemic, which of course they had a lot of money. We're talking billions of dollars mm-hmm. that states had. And yes, you had to pay for PPE and all these other things for testing, et cetera. But you could pump a lot more money into a lot of state agencies and fill other voids as well. Probably also noteworthy with the food share recipients banning them from using their benefits to purchase candy and soda. This is a huge discussion at the national level, something we can likely see maybe be enacted by RFK Jr. It would be a bill, I would assume, that Evers would veto. Same thing with AB 269. Now, I will disclose, I don't know where the governor stands on this, but there is a lot of opposition to that bill when it comes to Lyft drivers, DoorDash individuals receiving benefits. Right now, they are independent contractors, so they don't get those additional benefits. This would create a portal that they could access it. But a lot of opponents that I talked to this week about the bill is that, well, yes, it says they may have benefits. It doesn't actually require these companies to say, yeah, I'll distribute X amount into your benefit accounts. It would just create a portal and a pathway for it. All right, let's move on to another topic this week, which is the Department of Public Instruction saying that they are going to revamp student report cards and district report cards. Now, this is a tool that provides data on how districts are performing, and this effort comes after the agency made changes to their benchmarks for standardized testing, a move that critics argue make it nearly impossible to measure students' success. So what they're really trying to do here, JR, is we want to be transparent that we're making changes here because of the backlash that they received and still are receiving from those changes to cut test scores.
Look, they learned their lesson. They gave me a list this week of 30 people, roughly, on who are part of this panel. We're going to work on this. They met with John Jagler, the chair of the Senate Education Committee. I think they tried to meet with Joel Kitchens, the chair of the Assembly Education Committee. Didn't quite work out, but they're trying to get out front of this, say, hey, here's what we're doing. Here's who is involved, here's the timeline, here's when it'll apply, because they want people to know, look, it's been 15 years of these report cards, we need to update them, we want it on the up and up. Most of the people on the panel are from public school districts, but they're representatives from charter schools, virtual schools, Catholic schools, some are from CESA. So they kind of cover the entire gamut of education with this panel.
Right. And I think they were going to start doing some of these meetings in June. Mm-hmm. So we'll ultimately see what happens there. But again, I think they're just trying to be out in the open as much as possible because of what has happened in the past. What this change will see, I think it's going to take a few years, of course, to see these changes implemented and what actually how they measure students and districts as well in their performance. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to stock picks this week. Rising, hand-counted ballots. This is kind of a wonky ruling from WEC that does confirm that communities less of 75,000 do not need permission to stop tabulating ballots in their machines.
7,500, actually.
7,500, excuse me.
That's right. So here's the deal. Thorn Apple up in Russ County, it wants to hand-count ballots, use paper ballots, put them in a wooden box, and do it that way. Look, this is all about like this election integrity thing with Donald Trump and the whole theory that these electronic machines are somehow being manipulated to skew votes. Background, in 2020, Donald Trump did better in the communities that used a certain kind of voting machine than he did in 2016. So machines aren't the problem, okay? That said, there are people who are convinced, no matter what you tell them, that machines are a problem, hand counting is better. There are numerous studies that will tell you that hand counting is not better. That said, there's this issue with Thorn Apple. They want to go to hand counting paper ballot. There was a lawsuit filed and a complaint last year because if you are have a disability, you have to have an accessible machine to vote. They didn't have one for anybody with that. I don't know how many people have disabilities that were voting there anyway in Thorn Apple, but they have to have one there. Now we have this question, okay, they had electronic voting machines before, do they have to get permission from the Elections Commission to stop using them? The commission said state law is clear. If you have 7,500 people or fewer, you don't need permission to stop using electronic voting machines. You still have to have the one available for some of the disability, but in general, you can count by hand, that's fine. Now, the question is, what would it lead to? So Jefferson Davis is somebody who's a figure in the Capitol, election integrity crowd. Every election hearing you cover, he's there,
he's
right?
There. Mm-hmm.
All right. He put out a message right away. This was a breathtaking decision. This is an opportunity. They want to now go out and lobby smaller communities to stop using machines. They want to hand count everything. For example, Brown County, I think, is looking at buying new electronic voting machines. He put in that message that they should be calling people in Brown County and saying, don't buy new machines. Instead, all but 9 communities in Brown County could go to the hand count, and we should be doing that instead. Now, we know late nights covering elections.
I was just going to bring that up.
This could be an interesting addendum to the late nights. The question is, how widespread is it going to be? One, you know, you got to count how many communities are like less than 7,500 people. Okay, you get that number. How many are going to do this? And then how many ballots are being hand counted as it is? Davis pegged the number like north of 115,000 people. I asked the Elections Commission, okay, what's your best guess? And they said, look, this is tricky to figure out. One, how many communities are using hand count as it is, and two, the number of ballots. They guessed at most 150, and they said it's an educated guess. Like, they don't know for sure how people are doing it.
And it changes each election, too, how many people are voting.
And then two, they pegged at around 70,000 ballots being counted by hand. Now, remember, 3.3 million cast in November last year for president. Only smaller communities, so you're talking, you know, hundreds, few thousand ballots. But people will tell you when you count by hand, think of the number of races you have in November elections. So not just president last year, but president, U.S. Senate, Congress, legislature, Senate and the Assembly, local races.
Ballot referendums.
Mm-hmm. So you get to a rather large number for what you're trying to keep track of. That could be a challenge at times. So there's that issue going on. My question is going to be, again, what's the pressure campaign we're going to see from these election integrity folks of you guys need to do this going forward?
All right, something to keep tabs on. All right, Mix, this week we're going back to the conversation about Senator Johnson because of his talk about his political future. Now, I just threw this question out to him. Do you want to run for president? And I ask that only because he is one of the very few in Congress that will want to, who will willingly go toe-to-toe with President Donald Trump. But he also has nothing really to lose because most of us assume he's not going to run for a fourth term. But he didn't rule it out this week.
Yeah, well, he said... he said this before, kind of.
Yes, so, he did.
2016, he ran for re-election to a second term and said, I'm doing two and that's it. 2022, he said, I'm going to run for a third term because Democrats have full control of Washington, D.C. I have to be there. His first two ads out of the gate were spots saying, this is why I broke my promise. So when he says, I don't want to run for a fourth term, but you go, well, okay, there may be an attraction here because let's look at the reality of if Ron Johnson is not in office, nobody's putting him on a Sunday show to ask him about reconciliation. He doesn't have a perch on a Senate committee to run investigations. There is an attraction to being a U.S. senator. You know, you get to do a lot of cool stuff. Now,
yes.
Not that he loves everything about it or the politics, but the opportunity to weigh on things, that's pretty attractive. But the questions become, okay, 2028, you know, age, ability to do the job. The other thing is Ron Johnson ran as a citizen legislator. He was going to be just this guy, go to Washington and go back home. He said before the 2020 election, I don't care if I lose because I go back to Oshkosh. Okay, sure. But if you want to go for four terms, that's 24 years in the Senate. That's a career, right? So Ron Johnson is, if he were to run for a fourth term, how do you claim to be a citizen legislator anymore? That's kind of another question for him. But look, all in all, he's getting a heck of a ride right now out of this opportunity. The question is, will he seize upon it to stand his ground to get enough or to get all that he wants? People think it's going to be enough, but he's definitely in the spotlight. He definitely has an opportunity. And honestly, you know, incumbency is a powerful thing. He'd have a shot to win, especially in a presidential year. Don't forget in Wisconsin now, Republicans have a better shot in presidential years than off years. Now, who's running for president in 2020, lots of other things, but you get higher turnout, more casual voter Republicans than used to be in Wisconsin, so it could be a good year for him in 2028.
And Ron Johnson has this secret sauce that I like to say. I also asked him about this because he's one of the very few Republicans that can win statewide when Trump is on the ballot and when Trump is not on the ballot, because Republicans, as we talked, even at their convention, they're trying to figure out what is this formula. He didn't really have a good answer because looking at past elections, spring elections, midterms, presidential, the numbers are all wonky. But yes, Democrats in spring elections have their secret formula for some reason, just more Democrats turn out. But looking at those wow counties he pointed to and performance as well. So he could have a good record to run on just based on, hey, I'm the guy that can win here and I'm likable because a lot of people do like him. That's a good thing. But whether he wants to go on with the age thing, 2028, you know, stay in politics. I believe it was the first time he said, I'm only going to, you know, run for one term because my wife wouldn't want me to keep going. Well, I wonder what his wife thinks about right now. So we shall see. All right, let's get to Falling This Week. And we're talking about Judge Ellen Burrs. She was suspended by the state Supreme Court. And this kind of is an issue that has been brought into the light because of what's happening with Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Dugan as well.
So look, the Supreme Court, there was a complaint filed by the Judicial Commission against Burrs, and the court issued its rulings. Remember, judicial discipline, usually it is complaint with the commission, recommendation, Supreme Court ultimate say. The court unanimously ruled that she should be suspended for 7 days without pay starting in June 26th, I believe. because of two incidents in the court. And what she talked about, or the court talked about, was judges should be above the fray. She, though, got right into it. Two incidents. One, there was an exchange with a defendant that was somewhat sarcastic, and she basically suggested if he was trying to get a extension or delay in his trial, that I will remember this and hold it against you in the future if you do this. If this turns out to be a ruse. The real interesting one was there's a person who was for her court, wasn't there, what she was told, he was admitted to an emergency hospital. She ordered the bailiff to go find him and bring him back. They said, I can't do that. I'm in charge of security here in the courtroom. She grabbed the defense attorney and took her own personal car and drove to the hospital, or was going to the hospital to go get him. The attorney, according to the record, said, I don't think it's a good idea. So halfway there, they turned around. But the court said, this is unbecoming of a judge. You're doing something like this. This is problematic. And yes, in light of what we talked about with Dugan, it's interesting with judicial discipline. I looked up the records. She's Burrs is the seventh judge suspended in the last 30 years by the court through an issue initiated by the Judicial Commission. Dugan, though, was separate. Dugan was done by the court on its own accord.
Correct.
Another incident before that, no complaint was filed. Said, hey, we got to get you off the bench because of what's going on. Worth mentioning with Dugan, this week she filed a new motion to dismiss the charges against her. She's citing the U.S. Supreme Court decision that said Trump has immunity. She's saying that backs up my argument that I have immunity. So what she's saying is judges have immunity for stuff like this when they're in their official capacity. Remember, the Supreme Court with Trump last year said presidents acting in their official capacity have absolute immunity. If they're in a peripheral type situation, yeah. Not official act, no. Dugan saying, I was in my robe, I was in my courtroom, I was overseeing how things were going, I was acting in my official capacity. If he's got immunity, so do I. This should be dismissed. Second kick at that cat, trying to get rid of the charges before they go to trial.
All right, we'll see what happens. All right, that will do it this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next time.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, Your Week in Review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.